And joining me on the telephone for reaction is Alan Hirsch. Alan Hirsch is a lecturer in humanities, chair of justice and law studies at Williams College, and author of the book Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. Alan Hirsch, it is my good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio station.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you have dived into the two previous Senate impeachment trials that we have had in this history, Andrew Johnson in 1868 and then Bill Clinton in 1999. After observing and seeing what has happened in this, really the first day, officially the first day was last week of swearing in and everything, but now today debating and eventually voting on the rules of the Senate, what are you thinking about? What stands out to you?
To me, this is Alice in Wonderland, verdict first, trial later. And the verdict is not guilty. Virtually all of the Republicans have made it clear that that's the outcome they want. And right now, they're just trying to finesse the process so that politically this is as palatable as possible.
Now,
Well,
I was going to say, Mitch McConnell has relented a little bit on his original proposal that he unveiled last week. Again, instead of having just 2 days for each side to present 24 hours worth of oral arguments, it's now 3 days, which means it would be 8 hours per day. And then also allowing, he has changed and relented on the issue about evidence, not new evidence, but evidence that was acquired during the House impeachment inquiry to also be a part of the record.
Right. So not to be too cynical, but I can't help but thinking that he asked for the he proposed the ridiculous 2 days, which would have had the hearings go on past midnight, only so that he could propose the 3 days at 8 hours and claim it was a compromise.
Yeah.
When it's obviously still rushing this through. As for the evidence, as you point out, this is evidence everyone already knows about. So whether it's technically in the record is just that, a technicality. Obviously, what's at stake is, will there be any truth-finding, truth-seeking, which would require new evidence. It would require testing the proposition that the president did nothing wrong, and so forth, and there are witnesses prepared to testify to shed light on that. In the Andrew Johnson trial, there were 40-some-odd witnesses. In the Clinton case, there were only three who were deposed. That was by agreement between the parties, because neither side particularly wanted live witnesses. There's really no precedent for one side basically shutting down the inquiry before it begins.
What about the argument that the House should have tried harder to get these witnesses, to get these documents, that what the Senate should be doing is just considering the articles of impeachment based on what the House had at that time when it voted for impeachment?
It really doesn't make any sense. I mean, there's no rule. By analogy to the criminal justice system, what the House did was an indictment. There's no rule that once a prosecutor has indicted a defendant, they can't look for new evidence, that the only evidence allowed at trial is evidence that was presented to the grand jury or that was available to them when they drafted the indictment. There's no precedent for that argument. Is it true that the House could have sought to put on more testimony? Sure. And there was no obligation for them to do so. They found that the requisite standard was met for impeaching the president. And there's no reason at all that new evidence shouldn't be sought now. Had the House sought that evidence, had they subpoenaed John Bolton and others, they would have been tied up in a court fight for several months. And they made the pragmatic decision that that wasn't wise. That may have been a mistake. But if so, it was a political mistake. It wasn't the equivalent of what the House is doing now. Oh, I'm sorry, what the Senate is doing now, which is simply shutting down a process for their own advantage.
If they did go to the courts, and again, this is a moot point because the House is done with its work. But that I've heard that often, that it would just tie up the process in time because it could take months. Is it not possible the courts could have expedited such a process because of the importance and timeliness of it?
It's conceivable. And as I said, it may be that the House made a miscalculation. You know, that's outside my area of expertise,
yeah.
Just sort of the pragmatic workings of the House. And no one could have predicted how long the court process would have taken. Personally, I would have advised them to subpoena key witnesses and then to seek an expedited decision-making in the courts. I think that would have been wise. I think they made a mistake. But that was simply a mistake in calculation, in tactics. It wasn't shirking their duty, which in my opinion is what the Senate is doing now.
Let me ask you about criminal court case, and this isn't what that is, but since that's oftentimes being used as an analogy, is it common after the grand jury does its work and the person has been indicted and it's now to the trial to submit new information that the grand jury did not submit itself?
Oh, absolutely. You're under no obligation to be limited to what the grand jury saw. You have to understand there's a different standard. Before the grand jury, you only have to establish probable cause that a crime was committed, and then you have to prove the person guilty beyond reasonable doubt at trial. So it's not at all uncommon for the grand jury to be presented with minimal evidence, and then at trial you bring out all your evidence. And so there's nothing to that claim that the House was obligated to do all the legwork first before it got to the Senate.
Do you think that Adam Schiff is right in that not only, and he said this much earlier in the day, many, many hours ago, that this isn't just a trial against Donald Trump, but this is actually also going to be a trial, I don't know if you use the word trial, but that's what the word I'm using, of the Senate and how the Senate performs, how Congress performs through this process.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I think that history will make that judgment to some extent, but voters will get a chance to make that judgment in November. And I think that Democrats, obviously very frustrated that they're not getting what they consider a fair shake, a legitimate truth-seeking trial. But what they will get is the opportunity to litigate that in the court of public opinion. And I think that's all that's left. But in a democracy, that's also ultimately what's most important.
Do you not think that when they get to the point of voting on witnesses, and to be clear, according to the rules, it's not just we vote for witnesses and now we have them. They would be deposed first behind closed doors, and after that process, then they would decide who would actually give public testimony and who would not. Do you not have any hope in what may happen in potentially having witnesses? It appears there could be four or five Republicans that have expressed wanting to hear witnesses.
I have a little hope, and it's based largely on the public opinion polls, which show anywhere from high 50s to low 70s support for there being witnesses. And one would like to think that Susan Collins and three other Republicans who are nervous about their reelection prospects, or Mitt Romney, who doesn't have to worry about reelection, you would hope that four or five or six of them will be profiles in courage. But nothing that's happened today or really in recent history gives me cause for a lot of hope.
What do you think this does to impeachment? And again, I shouldn't say this again, but we've talked many times over the past few months. You've indicated that impeachment in many times in which it has happened, maybe the two Senate trials, at least, that we've had for Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton were not appropriate uses of impeachment. Is this just another in a string of how impeachment has been used so far?
Well, the difference is, in the case of Clinton and Johnson, I believe that the presidents did not commit impeachable offenses. So the misuse of the process was by those who sought to use impeachment too easily, too promiscuously. And I think here that's not the case. I think the Democrats were justified in impeaching this president. And I think the misuse of the process is by the Senate in not conducting a fair trial. But will this tarnish impeachment as a constitutional tool in the future? That's number one, that's a great question. Number two, I don't know. And number three, if so, that will be a tragedy for this country, because it really is a very important constitutional provision.
Why?
And if it is viewed solely as a political football, then it is diminished, if not eliminated, as a legitimate weapon, and we need it.
Talk to me about the importance of impeachment. Now, I understand the gravity of impeachment, because you're talking about removing a president who, at the very least, had won an electoral college to win the election. But constitutionally speaking, how does impeachment fit in with the overall Constitution?
Remember that we were rebelling against England because they had a king who was too powerful and oppressive, potentially. Now, one safeguard against that was having a president who had to be elected. And it wasn't a hereditary position, and he was term limited to a maximum of 8 years. That is very important, but it's not sufficient. Because what happens with a president who, for example, rigs an election or who achieves just ridiculous power for that 4 or 8 year period? The only remedy then is impeachment. Without it, we are at the mercy of a lawless president, and especially when his party is in the majority, you see what happens. But the paradox of impeachment is it can only succeed when it's got bipartisan support. So when you have a lawless president aligned with a supportive party, you get the position that we are in right now. And that's why we're all nervously awaiting to see if there are 4 or 5 Republicans. But think how pathetic this is. All we are hoping for is witnesses. Then do we have any confidence that there would be 15, or I guess it has to be 20 Republicans, who would be even open to the idea of convicting a president of their own party? And there's absolutely no reason to be optimistic about that.
In thinking about the two articles of impeachment, the first article is abuse of power, and that is about Donald Trump using his office for personal gain. That's the allegation. The second article of impeachment, to me, is the one I'm most interested in, and that is obstruction of Congress. And it's like obstruction of justice, but it's obstructing Congress. It is the White House's blanketed refusal to comply with any subpoenas or even allow any of its people, government officials we're talking about when we say its people, to come testify to Congress. Now, some people did testify anyways, but the people that you really need, like what they're debating now concerning this amendment to try to issue a subpoena to Mick Mulvaney, none of those individuals would come and testify. I mean, if this is successful, and it's really a political question as it will if it'll be successful or not, depending on what happens in the Senate. To me, it has always seemed we're looking at a very dangerous precedent upon previous precedents. This isn't a new dynamic of presidents always using perhaps overusing executive privilege. But this to me, just to do we've never seen a blanketed obstruction the way we are concerning this case.
Well, I agree that it's unprecedented, and I agree that it's concerning. But to be honest, I'm more focused on the abuse of power than the obstruction of Congress, because there is the courts as a remedy for the latter. They could have basically taken Trump to court on that. They could have subpoenaed witnesses and gotten rulings. And then had he defied those, I think you would have an airtight case for obstruction. So I'm more concerned about the fact that he defied the will of Congress and he sought political dirt against a political opponent and sacrificed the nation's national security and foreign policy to that. That, to me, is the more severe charge.
And finally, what will you be looking for here moving forward? And, conceivably, if it's up to Mitch McConnell, this may be all over by the end of next week. I have a hard time seeing that happen, but you never know. But perhaps over the next 2 to 4 weeks, what are you going to be looking for? What's important to you?
I think the main thing is the vote on whether to have witnesses. I think that's really where the action is. Because if that is shut down, this is game, set, match. If witnesses are allowed, then we are allowed the ray of hope. It will mean that several Republicans at least were forced to recognize the possibility that the case against the president could be serious enough to warrant his removal. And if there's at least that degree of open-mindedness, number one, that's a good thing in itself. And number two, the public will get to see the evidence. Maybe at the end of the day, everyone's assuming they know what John Bolton's going to say. We don't have the foggiest idea.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll come forward and surprise us and say, look, I didn't support the holdup of the aid, but I think the president really was concerned about obstruction or something else. But that's what we need to find out. And it seems to me right now there is such an asymmetry. It's often this shouting match between the parties, and you don't know who's in the right. But here it seems like one side is simply asking for access to the truth-seeking process, and the other is trying essentially to abet a president's cover-up.
You mentioned earlier that Andrew Johnson, I think it was something like 40 witnesses, testified in his. Now, Andrew Johnson, I don't know if they were all in the Senate trial, but that trial went 10 weeks. Bill Clinton's trial went 5 weeks. there were witnesses, but only three, and none of them came in person to testify. It was all on videotape and depositions. Why did that happen with Bill Clinton's trial?
So the context for Clinton's trial is in between the impeachment and the trial was an election. And the Democrats did surprisingly well, and the Republicans were left with little stomach for this whole process. So it was by joint agreement. That's the biggest difference between what we're seeing now and what happened in the Clinton trial. There was agreement between the leadership representing their respective caucuses that this was the compromise that was reached. They would depose the three witnesses. They would then make a determination of whether they would be brought before the Senate for a full examination and cross-examination. And then each side chose instead to use whatever snippets they wanted of videotape of the depositions, as you say. So the big difference, I mean, that was a limited trial, to be sure, but that was by agreement of the parties. They both thought it was in their interest to have essentially this limited trial. And if we got even that, I think a lot of people right now would take it. Deposing the witnesses and let the parties show what they want from it. The Clinton compromise imported to this case, I think we'd consider an acceptable outcome. But as of now, I'm not sure we're even going to get that.
Forgive me, I know I said last question two questions ago. I think this will be my last question. And that is about John Bolton, somebody you brought up earlier, who served as the National Security Advisor for a short time to President Donald Trump. Trump has indicated, at least the White House has indicated or strongly suggested, that if he was subpoenaed to come testify to the Senate trial, he would invoke executive privilege. That would obviously have to be, I guess, worked out by the courts. This would be unprecedented in a presidential impeachment, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, and it would not unfold the way the president is suggesting, because John Bolton has indicated that he's happy to appear before the Senate. His lawyers have suggested he would not be invoking executive privilege, which, in fact, I don't think he could invoke anyway. I think it would have to be invoked for him. I think the president's argument with respect to this is frivolous.
Really? Isn't the claim that executive privilege, legally speaking, is at its strongest point when it concerns national security? And I mean, he being the national security advisor.
That's accurate. But as far – it all depends what Bolton plans to say, which at this point we don't know. I don't think he has any interest in divulging classified information, for example. I think more or less he would confirm that what we know happened and that he was opposed to it. That's the expectation. But we don't know. And if he were deposed, there would be a reasonable period for the Senate leadership to claim that what he has to say would be too inflammatory, too dangerous to the national security for the country to hear. And then it could go to court if need be. Maybe the Democrats would agree with that. But right now, it's all speculation. Remember, the president didn't want anyone to testify. Some people testified anyway, and was America's national security threatened?
Yeah. And then there's talk that if he were to testify, it would be behind closed doors, not open to the public.
Initially.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see. I don't know. This is speculation cubed at this point, because my real fear is that the Senate's going to give a thumbs down to even his being deposed.
Alan Hirsch has been our guest. He's a lecturer in humanities, chair of justice and law studies at Williams College, and author of the book Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. Alan Hirsch, I thank you for taking time for us today.
Thank you.